friend you meet along the way.
Hello, and welcome back to Callum and David's Any Requests podcast. This is, of course, our weekly podcast where you, the listener, can donate £5 a month via Patreon and get us to do a podcast on absolutely anything you want.
That is absolutely correct. And this week we are entering once again, delving into the pool of moonlighting.
I love this show.
I mean, I don't have anything to say other than it's brilliant. Watch it.
I think I mentioned on the first one that we did, I definitely watched bits and pieces of it. Reruns. I think on like the Paramount Comedy Channel, which used to be a channel on Sky. I don't think it exists anymore. When I was like, 18. But I don't think I was old enough to really get the genius of it. And watching these recently, I'm like, this is genuinely one of the greatest television series ever made.
It's just unbelievable writing. It's just, I mean, you know, we'll talk about it. But I mean, from the first scene to the very last, the writing is impeccable. Like the first scene, I was like, this is incredible. I've got to talk about this scene as one of the most perfectly written scenes in television. And then the next scene was as good, if not better. And it just goes on like that for a glorious 45 minutes. And then it ends.
But it's not even just the quality. It's how ahead of its time it was. It's how boundary breaking it is in terms of playing with form of what they're making. I don't think, certainly never seen anything before. And there are very few series I can think of that have really done that since.
And then on top of that, like from a technical point of view and from an experimental point of view, all of those things, form-wise, of course. But on top of all that, then it also talks about social issues that are really very prevalent at the time and very like current stuff, which makes it quite literally cutting edge in every single way a program can be. I don't know why it isn't. Why aren't there the Moonlighting Awards for writing television? Why isn't every writer saying, "Oh, by the way, this Oscar's for Moonlighting"? Because that it must have just inspired so many incredible writers.
Yeah, and it's interesting that, you know, Glenn Gordon Caron didn't really have, I would imagine, the career trajectory that you'd think someone of that quality, of that skill, would have. When you look at people like Aaron Sorkin and, you know, we were talking earlier on that Trial of Chicago 7's got to be a shoo-in for the Oscars. I mean, he's already got one. And that kind of makes sense from Sports Night through to West Wing Studio 6. You look at that trajectory. And you know, you were mentioning before we recorded how you're surprised that you've never heard Sorkin talk about Glenn Gordon Caron because there is such parity there. And he must have been an influence.
The only thing I think that might have made it fly under the radar slightly more than it should have done, and perhaps now, is that I can see a lot of people going, oh, that's kind of left-wing liberal elitism because it's smart and it's quick and it's funny and it's morally quite well-balanced. And it, certainly in America, as we've seen for the last five, 6 years, you know, in the run-up to the Trump presidency and its duration, that is a very common trope of anything that is kind of smart, funny, and makes you think and well executed. Well, that must be by the liberal devil then, you know.
Yeah, I mean, also I think, you know, the show, and we've touched on this before, the show itself was kind of plagued with various things. There was a writer's strike in, I think, the second season.
Yeah.
There was the kind of start of Bruce Willis's film career happening simultaneously. He went off to a couple of Blake Edwards films, and I think that was during the third season, and so they suddenly had all these scheduling conflicts with him and Sybil Shepherd. And
so ratings-wise, you can see why it might have struggled a bit.
Yeah, and I think maybe that just created a kind of an unnecessary like negativity on set and during the production of it that maybe kind of plagued it, I think. So this is Sylvan, our long-time Patreon.
Thank you, Sylvan.
Patron. It's his ongoing request. And after the first couple of episodes, he's kind of left it up to us. Mm-hmm. So this week we've gone for the 1986 Season 3, Episode 6 episode called Big Man on Mulberry Street.
Yes. named after the song by Billy Joel, yeah. Big Man on Mulberry Street, which was an album track from a 1986 album. I can't remember which one. So it must have been very current.
I'll tell you something interesting about this.
Go on.
This song, Billy Joel wrote this song because he was inspired by watching an episode of Moonlighting.
What?
He was watching an episode of Moonlighting and went away and wrote this song.
Right.
And then called up Glenn Gordon Caron and went, just thought I'd let you know your show's inspired me to write this song. Sent him the song. So then Glenn Gordon Caron wrote this episode for the purposes of showcasing this song.
Okay. Right, this is utterly...
which is a weird backwards way of, yeah. how it would normally work.
We're doing but a right response within yeah. two different yeah. genres,
yeah.
Kings of popular culture. But again, Billy Joel's Billy Joel, right? Yeah. Even at this point, he's already pretty huge.
Yeah.
Why isn't Billy Joel, you know, doing a speech to... And this song is dedicated to Glenn Gordon Caron. I hope... Maybe he is, so I've never seen him do that in a live yeah. concert. But I... Oh, Billy Joel, come on, bring back... Put some money into a reboot of Glenn Gordon Caron's career.
Yeah.
That's okay. I don't know why I'm so passionate about that. But that's amazing. That yeah, is really, that that's a really cool story. Real yeah. cool. Yeah, and backs up all that good stuff we were saying about the show in general.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So as we talk through the episode, it will become clear kind of why we've chosen this one. Those of you that listen to us regularly know that we are both theatre makers. We're in the theatre industry and... There's a big reason why this episode kind of would speak to us, which is the one why we kind of picked it out. But even aside from that as well, I doing a bit of research, it's one that frequently features in the 10 best episodes ever of Moonlighting. So
right, yeah,
you could kind of see why as well.
So going through it, yeah. we open with a very kind of lingering shot on a commercial kitchen and some eggs being fried.
Yeah.
And we can hear the song Good Morning from
Singing
in the Rain. And it, again, I say lingering because it just stays on the breakfast a little bit too long. And then it follows a coffee pot and the coffee pot, again, tracking shot. Like a Sorkin Walk and Talk, but yeah. it's not a talking coffee pot. Although I wouldn't put it past Moonlighting to do that. Then we follow the coffee pot through into this hotel lobby. And we realise it's a hotel kitchen and people are breakfasting in the kind of this posh hotel in LA. And we see one conversation that's quite irrelevant, but we can see people doing business. And it's like a business breakfast.
Do you think Lorraine Kelly should... start a segment on her morning chat show that's like a talent competition for vocalists and call it Singing on Lorraine?
Yes. Yeah.
Okay, good. I think she should.
I think she recently named Piers Morgan her hero of the year for holding the government to account. And I think it was James Acaster mm-hmm. on the panel show. It was the last leg. Yeah. And he just told her to go F herself. He was like, "I'm really sorry, you're a national treasure, but it's a reaction that I have." Yeah, really interesting little weird political exchange on that kind of comedy bit.
Yeah.
Oh, Lorraine Kelly. Yeah, a weird one. Anyway, yes is the short answer. You should do that. So we go from this little business lunch and this coffee pot and we see hands moving. Again, it's not really relevant, but we just hear some hardball business talk. And then we move to the next table and there's also some hardball business talk and yeah. it's revealed that that is Sybil Shepherd having a meeting with a client.
Yeah. Now, I'm going to somewhat dubiously talk about the filming of this with some trepidation because it's a possibility that it was just... the way that it was formatted on the version we found. But given that everything else was in frame, I am inclined to think this was a deliberate choice, which is as the waiter goes from table to table filling the water, you hear conversations, businessmen, couples talking, friends, but you only see their hands.
Yeah.
And the rest of them are, as far as we could see, out of frame. I just really liked it. I really liked that... it was from the point of view of the water jug, which is really interesting.
It reminded me of, you might know what film I mean, a really old film. There's an iconic shot, and from the first of its kind, a French film, where the camera moves across a row of like 10 tables. And you do actually see the faces mm-hmm. of those people, but the focus is always the hands in the middle and the glasses and the drinks. And there's a famous gay kiss actually as well there, and it felt like a really arty shot though. I think
Spice World maybe.
I think it might have been. Yeah. I think it was Spice World.
So yeah, and
a silly mead.
The scene kind of ends on Sybil Shepherd and this client having a conversation, and she's kind of making excuses for why David isn't there. And you get a bit of expositional dialogue about. It's obviously, it seems to be a frequent, it's like 80% of their work seems to be divorce.
Yeah.
Trying to get investigating evidence. Yeah.
Well, partners. I think particularly difficult to get a divorce in the 80s and 86 in America, you had to have certain reasons and a lot of money to do it. And it was a lot cheaper if you could prove infidelity.
Yeah.
Because no one would admit to that, even if it was true without proof, because then you'd have to pay out more. So
yeah.
You can see why this might be. What rich people do, but yes, at least the second or third time we've seen it come up, and so she's waiting for these pictures, but again, like this character who you only see for 2 minutes, expertly played by this wonderful actor I can't remember the name of, and she has this kind of wonderful line about her husband where she just says, "I don't have time to tell you why my my husband's full of what his coffee tastes like." It's just like, you didn't have to write this but you chose to make this iconic line and an amazing, decent, full-on characterized performance, expertly written, even though it's just a jumping off point, it's just a setup, it's just a bit of exposition.
And it's why his excuses are a crock of what this coffee tastes like.
Alliteration
of crock and coffee is what it's just so
wonderful wordplay.
Precision. Yeah.
Yeah. They're waiting for David to turn up with the pictures.
Yeah.
And he eventually does.
Yeah. Looking a little bit disheveled, worse for wear.
Yeah.
Maddie makes some comments about his smell. And clearly been up all night by the
And he says, "I haven't got the pictures."
Yeah.
And he says, "Oh, I'm sorry, there was traffic on the freeway." And she said, "Oh, did a gin lorry fall over?" Little comments to the fact that he's obviously smelling of booze. And so they have this chat where she berates him, and
they then go back to the office.
Yeah.
And
she's annoyed because she might have lost the deal.
Yeah, and then they have this conversation, and because it's moonlighting. Like, in any other show, this would just be a conversation that would move the narrative of the story on purely from a kind of subjective character point of view of i.e. Maddie feels this way and is annoyed, David feels this way and is defensive, and that's level. But because it's moonlighting, it suddenly becomes like a 5-minute play about like the kind of like the sort of morality of decision making and how that affects other people, and
it
just becomes this much deeper conversation about human nature as it always does.
How we need to forgive people for being fallible, and how that doesn't make someone unreliable. That you can be dependable. That you can also choose who you are each day, and that you're not born with an identity of who you are, like your eye color or your genetic makeup, but the choices you make up who you are. And I'm like, we're like a hair's breadth away from going into the superego and the idea of who you are in terms of like 20th century philosophy.
There is also so much cross-cutting in this scene of the dialogue, which I love it in plays, I love it in TV and film, and it's not done nearly enough in that medium.
Not this time.
No, for those who don't know, it just means as in when two lines of dialogue are being spoken one over the top of each other, like you would in real life. Like, it's very rare that you go, "I'm going to say something and I'm going to stop," and then the person that I'm talking to says something. Yeah. Often you'll speak at the same time. And it's very rarely used in film and TV because I think they just think, oh, the audience will get confused because they don't know who to listen to.
Yeah.
But they just don't care in this.
Because they don't underrate their audience underestimate, should I say, their audience, which is what's so lovely to watch. So they have this chat, and he she kind of comes back in to have a conversation with him after they've called off, and she says, "Okay, let's have a chat about this. How are we going to get this thing back?" I'm not going to fire you.
Yeah.
But we need to talk about it. And he says, I'm sorry, I can't talk about any of this because I need to go to New York.
Mm.
And she says, what? And he says, yeah, well, I've got a funeral to attend.
Yeah.
She says, well, who was the funeral for? And he says, well, it's my friend. I haven't spoken to them for 9 years, yeah. but they were really close to me. And she's like, come on, you don't have to go. And he says, well, basically, he's my brother-in-law. I was married.
Yeah.
I was kind of married, he says, to his sister, and I need to go.
Yeah.
And it's important that I do. So he goes.
He goes. Yeah.
Meanwhile, there's a kind of weird comedy bit between Alice,
I can't remember her name, but a wonderful actor. Yeah, the receptionist.
The receptionist, where they work out the fact that actually they're both amazed and slightly obsessed by the fact that David was married and hadn't told them.
Yeah.
And so they run through his drawers. Anyway, Cybill Shepherd decides that it's not an issue. She's going to rise above it.
Yeah.
Obviously, there's a little hankering after him as their relationship has developed over the series. It's not out of the blue and gratuitous. But yeah, there's obviously a little bit of, oh, why didn't I know that about you? And, oh, if you are the type of man who could get married, then why don't you want to marry me? But, I don't want to be with you, but I want you to want me. All of that is played just with Cybill Shepherd's eyes.
Yeah.
And the subconscious vibes that she sends out from her. I don't know how she does it because it's not really in it.
I think having kind of read around it, because we've obviously not been watching chronologically, but from what I've read, I understand that this episode is kind of really the first time where she really lets her guard down about her feelings about David, because it's been often quite one-sided in terms of he's quite relentless with his flirtation towards her. And she just sort of puts up with it. You know, obviously kind of plays into that she, you know, that there is an enjoyment there and that she does flirt back. But in terms of actually a deeper level of feelings, this is the first time I think at this point in Moonlighting that you really saw that.
Yeah.
I think it's interesting that you just get that it's learning about this previous life he had and feel like the first time she's felt jealous, I think.
That's exactly it.
And I think that's what confuses her.
But it's so subtly written in and so subtly played.
Yeah.
You really believe it. You kind of go, yeah, I know what that feels like to be annoyed at being jealous of someone you didn't even really think that you cared about in that way. Yeah. And yeah, it's really nicely done. So she goes home to bed, runs herself a bath. And she's thinking, obviously, about David and him being in New York and, you know, how did he have a wife? And she goes to sleep. And then something amazing happens.
Yeah. So, yeah, this is the reason, really, why I picked this episode. Because what then happens is a 6.5-minute dance sequence.
Yeah.
Underscored by the Billy Joel song.
Big Man on Mulberry Street.
That we talked about at the beginning of the episode. And it's directed by Stanley Donen, who is known as the king of musicals on film. This is the guy that directed Singing in the Rain, which is obviously why they put the little nod.
That's why the little reference was in there.
And it is pure MGM Technicolor musical.
It's beautiful.
It's like nothing that would have been seen on TV, especially network TV at that point. And it's just it's just phenomenal. But
when you say full MG, I would say it's slightly more contemporary in its choreography, actually. Yeah. But I think that's also credit to the narrative that they're telling, because they tell the whole story of David and his ex, Tess.
Well,
according to Cybill's imagination,
Maddie's imagination, which I love, because a real niche pet peeve of mine in film and TV is when, and it's a trope that comes up again and again, is when a character imagines something about another character and they imagine it right, even though they're imagining it, and then they learn about the thing and that's true.
Yeah.
And what I really love is later on when she has a conversation in real life with David, it's a completely different story.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh, thank you. Like, that's just so nice. It makes it so clear. This is Maddie's imagination of how they met and got together and things like that all told through dance, which is, you learn, is completely not true at all.
Yeah.
And not the way anything happened. But it's so, yeah, it's beautifully choreographed. A lot of Steadicam for this.
Yeah.
Which is great. A lot of Bruce Willis showing that he can actually dance really well.
He's a really good mover.
Yeah.
And yeah. And the performances are just really, really lovely. Like, yeah. I'm not a massive contemporary dance freak. I mean, I probably more than the average person because yeah. because I'm in that world of theatre yeah. and performance, and there's a professional appreciation there. But it's just, I defy anyone not yeah. to love being told that story that way.
Yeah.
And also, Billy Joel, no matter what you think of the guy personally or whether you love his music or not, you can't deny the fact that he is an absolute master of telling stories yeah. through songs.
Oh god, he's one of the best lyricists of all time.
Yeah,
has
yeah.
to be.
Humongously talented.
I genuinely think Piano Man might be the best written pop song ever.
It's hard to argue.
just stunning, stunning lyrics. And it just fits so perfectly. He's exactly who the character of David Addison would be listening to.
Yeah,
like, it just
yeah.
makes sense with him, with the story, with what you're watching.
And it's set in New York, and Billy yeah, Joel is the voice of New York, especially
the
in the 80s.
Saxophone, and yeah. It's beautiful piece of choreography. And this is what I meant at the beginning, where I was saying about playing with form. It's one thing to have, you know, a minute, 2 minutes. But for nearly 7 minutes to have no dialogue, to have a full 7 minute Billy Joel song and a complete dance sequence for that long, a third of the episode almost, it's like that's
yeah.
phenomenal.
It is, and to be honest, actually it reminded me of a great series that sadly got cancelled that we both really enjoyed, Giri Hajj.
Oh yeah, yeah,
which is a phenomenal contemporary kind of police procedural, but that's really reductive. It's yeah. much more than that. If you haven't seen it, but you've been thinking about it, please do watch it. It's a co-pro between the BBC.
Yeah, it's on Netflix now.
Yeah, beautiful. And there was a particular episode where they used medium of dance.
Yeah,
I can't think of any other thing that uses it in a kind of similar storytelling way.
I mean, La La Land sprung to mind instantly because of that
yeah.
end where it does the imagined life they might have had if they'd stayed together all through dance towards the end there. I instantly thought, god, Damien Chazelle must know this episode of Moonlight.
Yeah.
It's so similar.
But even that, form-wise, that is a musical in yeah. which they dance and sing in, whereas yeah. this is absolutely not. It's a yeah. sitcom about two private
Very
detectives.
True. Yeah.
But yeah, similar in that sense. Yeah, definitely. So it's beautiful and worth watching alone for that piece. And yeah, we kind of learn of what Sybil thinks, you know, has been going on in David's past life and therefore yeah. in his mind now. And she decides immediately when she wakes up from this dream
yeah.
that she's going to fly to New York.
Yeah.
And we don't really know why. We don't really know what her motivation is or intention is, but she books a flight.
Yeah.
And the next thing we know, she is on her way. We then cut back to Bruce Willis. Yeah. In New York.
Yeah, and it's just this really lovely, intimate scene. It feels like something out of, that Irish playwright that wrote The Weir.
Conor McPherson.
Yes, Conor McPherson. It feels like that kind of, just like men in a pub.
Having normal conversations.
Yeah, it's yeah. just really kind of subtle, real, kind of down to earth writing that, again, you just much more commonplace in a play and something on stage than you'd see in a drama, because in a TV drama, because it doesn't, they don't care about driving the narrative storyline.
Yeah,
like every episode, and maybe this is just the episodes we've chosen to watch, but every episode we've seen so far has no episode has had anything to do about any case.
Well, it's not really about that,
no,
is it? That's
no,
the setting, and that's
great.
How you get the show on the air, is you
yeah.
convince the producers that it's going to be about, you know, an investigation
yeah.
and a police procedural, basically.
Yeah.
We'll follow that format. And then they go, oh, I tricked you. Actually, it's about none of that.
Yeah.
It's about wonderful writing, wonderful characters, and some moral discussion. And I just think that it's fantastic.
And so, yeah, so they kind of have this conversation. They're reminiscing. They sing the theme of Top Cat.
Yeah. I mean, there's absolutely no reason they do the whole of the theme of Top Cat.
Yeah.
And there should be an exec going, guys, we can't we can't do 2 minutes of Top Cat. Like, we can't do that. We've got shareholders. Come on. We've got to keep the eyes on the prize.
Yeah.
And you're going, well, really? You've just had 6.5 minutes of Billy Joel contemporary dance, so...
Were you imagining Jack Rudolph there?
Yeah absolutely. Come on! You're killing me here! My wife left me. Oh, I have a small drinking problem.
I no longer recognise the authority of the FCC.
Not Jack Rudolph?
No, I know. It's Wilfred White.
Wonderful.
But... Wonderful. Wilson White.
Wilson White. We never know his name.
We don't know. Welcome to the Studio 60 podcast.
Yeah, I mean, please someone do that. Because I've invested so much of my life in Studio 60 on the Sunset Strip that I need to put it to good use somehow. Because I think I'm at a point where I'm going to have to start writing it as if I've written it.
Yeah.
Even though it's not. I don't know what I'm going to do with that love for that show. Brilliant show. Anyway, sorry. Yeah. Back to what was it? Moonlighting we were talking about. Fine.
There's a really lovely way of explaining that David's brother-in-law killed himself.
Yeah.
Which is two lines. One of the friends around this table says, "Did you ever get one of his crying phone calls?" And another one went, "Yeah, I just used to hang up." And that's all you get. And immediately you go, "Oh, he." Suffered from depression and killed himself. Like, it's just so beautifully
Well, there's a little bit before that where the other guy first says about him ringing up.
Yeah.
And he says, "I wonder if he saw the car coming and maybe didn't want to be..." But it's really subtle. But there's also, you're right, because of the end of that being, "I just used to hang up."
Yeah.
There's an acknowledgement between all these men, of which there are four or five, and they're being kind of brash in New York and... you know, ballish and they all kind of admit that they're rubbish at talking about their emotions and it might kill them all one day, just like it did their friend Jimmy.
Yeah.
And no one talks about it, but they all know that that's what they're admitting to and talking about.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's really like you're all singing Top Cat because you don't know what to do because your friends killed themselves and you don't want to talk about it.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a real moment of intimacy between like borderline toxic masculine males.
Yeah.
Kind of all, everything is shared in the words unspoken around that table. There's also a really nice layer of that as well in Bruce Willis during that conversation, not really engaging because he's playing like, "I didn't even get a phone call. That's how removed I've been." Like, he couldn't even engage in hanging up because he didn't even get the chance to hang up because he'd been so out of touch with him that he wouldn't have even been thought of to have been phoned.
Yeah.
And he kind of plays this and then he kind of goes off and phones Maddie because he can't engage in this conversation about the gun that's bringing these feelings of guilt. And all of this is in no lines at all. It's just completely in the energy that Willis has.
And I think that, you know, the older I get, the more I relate to stories like that. There are people who I absolutely kind of ran with in the
get away with saying the phrase "ran with."
The group of people,
mean streets of West
that
Brompton.
I grew up with. Yeah. These people raised me, you know.
I love it.
Yeah, the mean streets of West Oxfordshire were a very dangerous place for the likes of me. But there are people who I bonded with as a teenager.
Yeah.
Is the point I'm trying to make, who I no longer speak to, and some of this for very good reason. Mm. But at the same time, to get that phone call, like, that you never lose that impact of those people in your life.
Yeah.
And that's something that's just really nicely touched upon in terms of David as this probably kind of mid-30s character who is going through this. He then leaves the table to make a phone call.
I talk to them.
You talk to all my friends.
All your friends.
Yeah. Yeah. They're fine. And you still talk to your friends, but they like me more.
Yeah.
It's fine.
Yeah.
So he goes to make this phone call. And we don't know who he's calling, but he makes a point of making sure that the phone call is charged to his own number. And while he's making this phone call, and we stay on him for the whole thing while he's talking to the operator, and it's really realistic. And in the background, you've got Billy Joel's New York State of Mind playing as well. Yeah. And I just thought, why is that not cheesy? Why is that not too much? Why is it perfect?
Yeah.
I think I wouldn't have made that decision because of being afraid of all of those things. And I'm so glad that they did, because it's an excellent choice. It's so lovely.
I've never been to New York. I was in JFK Airport for 12 hours, but that doesn't count.
Got the t-shirt.
When I do go for the first time, I think I'm just going to wander around listening to Billy Joel and just imagining that it's underscoring in my life.
Yeah.
Because he is New York, isn't he?
I think if you wander around New York with your headphones in, listening to Billy Joel, imagining that you're in his life, you'd probably get hit by a cab quite quickly.
Yeah.
Or maybe mugged.
Maybe. And then I think if I, like,
apologies to a New Yorker, it wasn't. It's a lovely place. It's cleaned up a lot now.
The minute you'd wander over into New Jersey, I'd have to change to Bruce Springsteen.
I mean, of course you would. Yes.
And so David then leaves this message for Maddie, hangs up, goes back to his
hotel. That's a nice kind of reveal that he's calling Maddie to say, "This is where I am. I'm safe. It's okay."
Yeah.
I hope you're all right. We'll talk in the morning. And also the fact that he hasn't made her pay for the phone call. There's a kind of very small nod to responsibility, the type of which we were talking about in the opening kind of segment.
He's
just something there.
Learning and growing.
I think that's kind of what it represents. Yeah.
So then he turns up at his hotel and opens the door, and Maddie's sat on his bed, and then gives the most phenomenal monologue. That, again, I don't know why I still am surprised at the quality of the writing and performances in this show. But again, it's American network television. It's just you don't expect this level of quality.
No, but it's I just wrote, Sybil monologue equals beautiful was my note.
Yeah.
And I didn't really think, I don't have much else to say about it, because it is just beautiful.
Yeah.
It's beautifully constructed. It's wonderfully delivered.
Yeah.
It takes you into a part of Maddie's character that you haven't seen before.
Yeah.
It delves into some of what you were talking about that was hinted at before about her relationship with David, and the fact that she's not sure why she's there, but she's
really all the monologue is. And it's about 2 or 3 minutes. And really it's just her saying, I don't know why I'm here. But it's just so beautifully done. And again, it's written, you know, so much of TV, American and British, is written too perfectly.
Yeah.
And there are so many half-started sentences. Mm-hmm. There's trailing off, getting words wrong. Like, it's written so realistically.
Yeah.
And played so realistically. And uber naturalistically, that it just completely goes, oh, is this a play?
Yeah. Like,
it's just amazing.
I mean, there also are a lot of plays that are pretty badly written and don't follow any of those tropes. But don't go see those shows. They're rubbish and they're old-fashioned. But there is a great testimony to say that. And you do see a lot more of it in stage work. But there's something that's the biggest punctuation of this monologue, I think, is we talk often about the fast cross-cutting, the absolute going like the clapper's pace of this dialogue and how fast it was, especially when we talk about like formatting of network television being 42nd page and how this is kind of, you know, almost double that in terms of the rate at which the actors speak. Well, Bruce Willis doesn't say anything for the whole of this scene. And David's silence is really, really noticeable and huge.
Yeah.
About this man who doesn't really listen, completely listening and taking in everything that she's kind of said. And he acknowledges it.
Yeah.
And then closes the door and they go to bed. And then he knocks on her door.
Yeah.
And she's up, awake, lying on the bed, having not really moved from when she did the monologue. And he comes in and acknowledges that it was a bit of a mean thing to do to suddenly tell you this thing about my life being married, and I should probably tell you a little bit more about it.
Yeah,
I didn't want to talk about it, but I feel I should. Again, is that decision informed by the fact that none of those guys talked about their feelings and that's why they ended up in trouble? I don't know.
Yeah.
And then I wrote, Bruce monologue, equals also beautiful. Those are the last two notes of it. I wrote it. It's just stunning.
Yeah.
And I think it's a weird kind of, as a writer, when you've written a really good monologue, you then go, right, that's it. Let's move on to the next section, because everyone's going to be reading from that, a beautiful monologue, and we're going to need to change the energy, and, you know, you don't want to cock it up.
Yeah.
But, you know, quit while you're ahead, right? Yeah, move on to the next. But Glenn Gordon Caron just goes, oh, that was excellent. That might be some of the best writing I've ever done. And so I think I'll just do it again, perhaps slightly better. Like, who does that? Who has the gall to do that? It's like getting a hole in one on a golf course and then doing it again.
Yeah.
So he's outrageous talent. And a real kind of middle finger up to writers like myself, who would be so happy with that first monologue. I'd go, right, that's it, shut the book, leave it.
Yeah. Yeah.
But no, he comes on and does this amazing monologue about what really happened.
Yeah.
So we already know the imagination
of
Mandy through the dance.
Yeah.
But he explains what happened and tells this amazing story about being young.
Yeah, childhood sweetheart.
Childhood sweetheart, having unprotected sex.
Yeah.
At a time when, you know, it was the 70s, and not every woman's on the pill kind of thing. And it being wonderful and beautiful, but also having this, talks about being in a conversation with God about, please don't let her get pregnant. I'll never do it again, I promise, because I know what that means. That means that I have to give up my, you know, dreams and aspirations.
Going to be one of those guys working in a gas station in the same town, you know, and all that kind of thing. Yeah.
Anyway, she does get pregnant and they get engaged.
Yeah.
And, you know, does the right thing. But they have a miscarriage. And as a result of that, the woman, Tess, decides that she wants to follow her dream of being a dancer.
When Campbell said does the right thing, that was in quotations.
It was considered doing the right thing, wasn't it? It was what it was called.
I was just making sure that our listeners didn't think that you're incredibly old-fashioned in your views.
Well, I think you all know by now I am a staple of the GOP's pro-life policy. No, I don't. I'm not. No.
It was blew past it as if that was you saying, of course, did the right thing, as we all should do.
Okay, yep. And
no child born out of wedlock in this house.
No, absolutely not. She says she's going to go to New York to be an actor, to be a performer.
And he goes
with her.
So she can kind of, fulfill her dream.
He gets a job tending bar. Greenwich Village, and he says one day he came back from work to find her having sex in bed with the, I probably could have said one of those two things, but really it punctuated it.
Yeah,
having sex in bed with the census taker, a gentleman had come round to take the census, and apparently she'd invited him in and they'd end up having a romantic fling, and he caught them in the act, and then he stormed out never to return.
And then he just walked out of the Maddie's room.
Yeah, and that's the end of it.
That's the end of again,
her completely silent for it.
Yeah.
Big statement. It feels like there's a real intimacy.
Yeah.
Just being able to talk and just being able to listen.
So yeah. So the next morning they get ready to go to the funeral.
Yep.
Maddie's obviously coming with him.
Well, he just says, knocks on the door and says, "Maddie, are you up? I've got to go soon."
Yeah, and she's dressed in.
Up to the nines
in black, obviously, funeral. And then there's a gag about normally she'd wear hot pink, but she felt bad. Waking the dead, yeah.
You can tell he's spellbound by her beauty at that point.
Yes, yeah. There's a moment of kind of, he's a bit lost for words. He sees her. They're meant to go to the funeral.
But he has this. They have this really difficult conversation where David says, "Look, you can't come with me."
Yeah,
and Maddie's feeling really, really hurt by this because obviously she has come all this way, as he said last night. You know, what an amazing thing to do. you've come to support me. And she's like, yeah, I have done all that. And now you're saying I can't go to the funeral with you. What am I going to do? Sit on my own and I feel rejected, essentially. It's like being rejected on a date. That, you know, there's a romantic rejection there, but a friendship rejection there as well. Mm-hmm. And he says, it's not I don't want to take you. It's just
what I do to you every day, isn't it? Reject your friendship.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But every day. Mm. So it's
the pain gets less and less.
Well, maybe I'm just thinking it's like an abusive relationship, isn't it? It kind of, you become inured to it, but actually eventually I'll snap.
Mm-hmm.
And anything could happen then.
Anything could. It'll probably be a 7-minute contemporary dance.
I mean, most likely. Yeah. It would be. Yeah. Who knows? We'll let you know when that happens. In the meantime, yes, David said, it's not that I don't want to take you. It's that I've had too much trouble getting myself here. Mm-hmm. I can't take you as well. It's too much for my emotions. I've not seen Tess, my ex-wife, in 9 years.
Yeah.
Haven't seen a lot of these people in a long time. You know, you can kind of get where he's coming from. He says, come on, go out and have a fun time in New York. So he goes off to the funeral. And Maddie eventually decides in, what, early evening to go and find where he is because he's not back yet.
Yeah.
So she says, right, oh, screw this. I'm going to go to find where he is. And she does. She's a private investigator. She tracks down where the wake is being held, which is at Tess Addison's residence.
Yeah.
So she goes there.
Yeah.
And she kind of talks her way into the funeral.
Talks her way in, then pretends to be a friend of Tess's.
Yeah.
Then awkwardly, the person that she pretends to be the Tess friend to is like, oh, Tess, it's your friend. And Tess has no idea who she is.
It all backfires.
And then Maddie goes out to this fire escape and Tess comes out. So obviously she thinks something's a bit weird.
Well, I think she does say, can I talk to you in private? Yeah. And they decide to have this chat on the fire escape.
And again, just another lovely, intimate
conversation,
dialogue scene, just brilliantly written, where we learn that actually David walked in on her with another woman.
Yeah. And it's apparent to everyone that he's lied about that fact. It wasn't it wasn't a man. It wasn't the census guy. It was a woman.
Yeah.
And Tess doesn't say this, but there is the suggestion that the reason he has never been able to, you know, clear the air with her and kind of reconcile their very young relationship and her cheating on him is because there's something kind of shameful about him being cheated on with another woman. Like there's something emasculating about it.
Yeah.
And it's never said explicitly.
No.
And that's really important, I think. But again, bookended wonderfully when you think about the conversation of those 4 or 5 guys around the table, right?
Yeah.
Having this, not being able to quite handle being emasculated. There's a little bit of a homophobic comment when one says, where you go? And he says, why do you want to watch? Because he's coming to the toilet. And there's a slight macho nature to that.
Yeah.
And that is very relevant in David's characterization throughout Moonlighting as a series.
Yeah.
And so, there's this touch on, and Tess kind of gives this knowing nod. She's like, it's interesting that he lied about that. Okay, well, you know, if you ever see him, I want to talk, you know, let him know that I'm here and I would love to be able to see him again and talk about some stuff because we've got some, what's the word? I don't know, old...
unfinished business.
Unfinished business. There needs to be some closure,
clearly.
Whilst this conversation is going on, David is in a cab.
Yeah. Yeah, he's in the back of a cab, which he's got to just park up and run the meter.
Yeah,
and he's, I think, on using it as a therapy session, basically.
Is it on the Hudson Bridge?
I think so,
which I think is the bridge that Jimmy drove off or crashed on. And you're right. He's just running the meter and running it, using it as a... talking to this cab driver.
Yeah.
Kind of monologuing.
Yeah.
But talking about her cheating on him, again, with a man.
Yeah.
Even though he's just talking to us random kind of cab driver. And it's kind of comically done, but also quite heartbreaking. You know, he's drinking and he's saying, why am I running? Why am I playing hooky from a funeral? I didn't think I was going to do that. Maybe I did know deep down I was never going to go there. I'm not really brave enough. Am I being a coward? I don't know.
Yeah.
And then he kind of says, you know, what do you think?
Yeah. And you get this brilliant, undercuts the pathos with a lovely bit of comedy in terms of the guy turns around and I think it's Russian or some kind of
maybe
European.
Polish or Russian or something.
Obviously he hasn't understood a word that David said for the last 5 minutes, which is just lovely. And
tagged with
quite annoyed.
Tagged with David saying, "Oh well, everyone's entitled to their opinion."
Lovely bit of comedy at just the right point as well, where it needed a bit of levity. Karen always knows where to put that in.
Yeah,
paces like humor perfectly. And then there's a little bit of them back at the. There's not. He goes back to the hotel and Maddie's asleep. And then,
but he blows her a kiss.
He blows her a kiss, and then they're on the plane.
Yeah,
back to LA.
And she's kind of,
he's still perpetuating this lie about it being another guy.
Mm-hmm.
But he plays it in a way like he knows she knows the truth. And so he's letting
because
her
she
know
says
that
I
he's
went
not ready yet to talk about that.
Yeah.
So therefore, I'm letting you know that I'm still going to go along with this lie.
I'm going to reinforce the lie. I'm going to ask you to play along with it.
Yeah, which is really interesting.
Even though I know if you went there and talked to her, you know the truth.
You know the truth. Yeah, yeah.
So yeah, it's a really kind of weirdly loving thing she does by not pulling him up on it.
Yeah.
And it's the type of thing Maddie would do, would be, what? I found out the truth. You lied to me. And instead she just goes, like you say, her eyes say, I understand you're not ready.
Yeah.
But you know I know, and that's enough. And you know I'm kind of here for you. And she says, do you want half the blanket?
Yeah.
And he opens one eye, he's kind of semi-napping. He says, oh, we can sort that out when we get back to your place.
Yeah.
She's such a...
such a David line. And it's just...
Yeah, but we haven't had any of that in the whole episode.
No. But it's like he's resetting them ready for the next episode.
Yes.
So you don't leave. It's not like, oh, and then the next episode, everything's forgotten about. It's like bringing them to a point of conclusion and then before the next episode started, he's putting them back in the place they need to be.
There's continuity there.
Which is lovely.
And and she said she wanted half the cover and makes that comment. And she says, he says, yeah, I would like some of the blanket. So she puts the blanket over him. And she says, on the condition I can have half a shoulder.
Mm-hmm.
And then he has this lovely line where he says something along the lines of, you can have half my shoulder.
But only for the next 20 or 30 years.
And then I'm going to need it back.
Yeah.
And there's something where I, as a kind of viewer, went, oh. And she just looks as if to say, are you saying that you care about me enough as a friend and you want to be my friend for 20 or 30 years? Or are you saying that we should be together?
Yeah.
We've just got to sort out when, but we end up together, by the way.
Yeah.
Is that... And they don't know, and we don't know.
Yeah.
But it's lovely. And then that's it. That's the end of the episode.
Yeah.
We kick in with a little bit of the... like a musical... kind of arrangement of the middle section of the Billy Joel number.
Yeah, Big Man on Broadway Street, yeah. Just lovely.
It's a perfect bit of television, it's a perfect bit of dramatic writing, it's a perfect bit of comedy writing.
Yeah.
There's not a single bad performance in it. I don't know how you do a show like Moonlighting that is so dense, dialogue-wise, and then, oh, by the way, you've both got 3-minute monologues in here, at least. That are going to require like real work. Like this is what actors talk about, and they're like, "Oh, it takes time to prepare." Like a lot of acting is just learning the lines and then going up and doing it. You know the characters; it's fine. But when you get stuff like this, you have to actually go and do homework and like take a pencil out to your script and do loads of notes, and you know, and you're getting this dialogue, you know, hours sometimes before you're actually shooting the scene, maybe a day or two at the most, but. You know, this is especially, you know, if you've also got a burgeoning, you know, movie career, and, you know, Sybil Shepherd was doing all sorts of things at that time as well. So it's really impressive from a technical feat of those two performers, I think, to carry that show.
Yeah.
I mean, they would have had probably a week to shoot that episode.
Yeah.
Which gives you about 4 shooting days.
Yeah.
You know, it's not easy.
No. I mean, that's got to have been at least a day, the dance sequence alone.
Oh, I think probably more probably than that. More. Yeah.
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 Especially in MGM days, that would have been, they worked quick, but probably a good week to do it, yeah. A number like that.
And just such a lovely thing to have Stanley Donen come in and do it. The authenticity there is not just, oh, we're going to pay homage to the great MGM musicals. We're going to have the guy that made them come and direct the homage. Like, just...
And he's going to say yes.
Insane, yeah. Yeah.
And also the fact that that wasn't the thing we're talking about most. The thing we're talking about most was that the episode was inspired by a song written by Billy Joel, which because he was inspired by Moonlighting, and then Glenn Gordon Caron went and wrote this in response to that. Like, the whole thing that you had MGM's kind of major Hollywood director come in and do the dance sequence was almost by the by. Which is just, what an obscure sentence.
Yeah.
But what a joy. And I just thank you, Sylvan, again. I cannot believe this isn't a better known thing.
Yeah. Yes, thank you for your continued support, because it's just lovely that we get to revisit this series every several weeks. It's fab.
There are some things that's great about doing this podcast, is that as well as it kind of being a fun hobby and something that keeps us occupied whilst we can't make or go anywhere or, you know, socialise. And it's so much more than that when you get things like this where you go, I'm being asked to actively engage with a piece of beautiful, you know, material, a piece of art. And then I get to talk about it afterwards. Yeah. It's just a real luxury. I just sitting there thinking, God, this is nice, isn't it?
Yeah.
So thanks for that.
Did you not feel like that about Jonathan Creek then?
I did, but that was a slightly different project. That was like, I felt grateful, but I don't think I'd describe it as a beautiful, perfect piece of art.
Did you not? That's weird. That's weird.
I'm sorry, folks. I feel like I might have let down the fact, I've let the mask slip.
Would you describe the painting of the grinning man as a beautiful piece of art?
I don't know.
The anachronistic pipe.
I don't know what that was about, that pipe. I feel like it... Oh, I get tired when I think of that Jonathan Creek podcast, you know?
Yeah.
I'm interested to see if that... If, they will have to eventually do another one, right?
They will do. And no matter where we are or what we're doing, we're going to have to come together and record an episode.
Be flying across the world at that point.
Absolutely.
There'll be no COVID and we'll... I just also... remember, Sylvan said, because of the Jonathan Creek podcast, they also thought, oh, another crime show with a will-they-won't-they relationship, also called Maddie. There are kind of relations... You know, there's a link between Moonlighting and Jonathan Creek. No, there isn't. There absolutely isn't. There's no link at all. Moonlighting's brilliant. Jonathan Creek is a deeply flawed, deeply loved, including by me, piece of thing that happened.
I think the Jonathan and Maddie dynamic, I think Rennick was inspired by the dynamic of David and Maddie.
But he accidentally wrote a psychopath. Maddie.
Yeah, he did. He did.
Rude magician man.
He did. But I don't think that was it. I think his intention was to create a dynamic that was influenced by Maddie and David.
Maybe.
I think that's where the connection is. I would bet money that she's named after Maddie from Moonlight.
Maybe,
I bet.
Okay. Who do you think you'd replace Sybil Shepherd with if in Moonlighting, if, like, Caroline Quentin... Sybil Shepherd left the series early and you just wanted to carry on. Who would you replace that with?
Julia Swallow.
Yeah, perfect.
Yeah.
I agree.
Good.
That's it. I've got nothing else to say. No. Beautiful piece of work.
Do you know who I would replace her with?
Kim Diane Cattrall. Keaton.
Kim Cattrall.
Oh, Kim Cattrall.
Yeah.
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 As a different character, though.
Yeah, as a different character.
Yeah.
No, I'd just do the Aunt Viv from Fresh Prince. Just have her come in.
Double take. That was weird, isn't it?
So good.
We should
so good.
Continue this conversation off the air.
I think they're fascinated by this.
You're right, fine. Yeah, we can keep going.
No, you're absolutely right. We have no more to say. Just a wonderful, wonderful episode. Thank you once again, Sylvan. Sylvan, feel free, if you do have any more specific episodes, let us know. Otherwise, we will keep going.
Picking a random one each week.
Yeah, any other Moonlighting fans out there, feel free to get in touch and let us know if there are any other particularly standout episodes we should look at whilst we're carrying on down the Moonlighting train. And you can do that, of course, by getting in touch with us on Twitter at Macabre Podcaster. You can get in touch with us on Facebook, fb.me/podcastermacabre. You can get in touch with us via email, podcastermacabre@gmail.com. And of course, you can like, share, and subscribe and listen to this podcast, any of our previous any requests, any of the Podcast Macabre Jonathan Creek episodes on Google Play, Spotify, iTunes, Anchor, wherever else you get your podcasts from.
That is correct. In the meantime, I've been Callum Hughes.
I've been David Shopland.
We'll see you next week.
Bye.
Bye. Someone by night.